A few minutes later, Dr. Lorne opened his back door and Vimes brushed past the body over his shoulders. "You minister to all sorts, right?" said Vimes. "Within reason, but this one's an unmentionable," said Vimes. "Tried to kill me. Need some medicine." "Why is he unconscious?" said the doctor. He was wearing a huge rubber apron and rubber boots. "Didn't want to take his medicine." Lorne sighed, and with a hand that held a mop, he waved Vimes towards an inner door. "Bring him right into the surgery," he said. "I'm afraid I'm cleaning up after Mr. Salsiferous in the waiting room."
"Why, what did he do?"
"He bust." Vimes, his natural inquisitiveness suddenly curbed, carried the body into Lorne's inner sanctum. It looked quite different from when Vimes had last seen it, but then he'd barely been capable of taking in details. There was the table and a workbench, and all along one wall were racks of bottles. No two bottles were the same size. In one or two of them, things floated. On another wall were the instruments. "When I die," said Lorne, inspecting the patient, "I'm going to instruct them to put a bell on my tombstone, just so's I can have the pleasure of not getting up when people ring." "Put him down, please. Looks like concussion."
"That was me hitting him," said Vimes helpfully.
"You broke his arm, too."
"That's right."
"You made a very neat job of it. Easy to set and plaster him up. Is there something wrong?" Vimes was still staring at the instruments.
"You use all these," he said.
"Yes. Some of them are experimental, though," said Lorne, busying himself at his work table.
"Well, I'd hate you to use this one on me,"
said Vimes, picking a strange instrument like a couple of paddles tied with string. Lorne sighed.
"Sergeant, there are no circumstances where the things you're holding could possibly be used on you," he said, his hands working busily. "They are of a feminine nature."
"For the seamstresses," said Vimes, putting the pliers down in a hurry.
"Those things. No, the ladies of the night take pride these days in never requiring that sort of thing. My work with them is more of, shall we say, a preventative nature."
"Teaching them to use thimbles, that sort of thing," said Vimes.
"Yes, it's amazing how far you can push a metaphor, isn't it?"
Vimes prodded the paddles again. They were quite alarming.
"You're married, Sergeant," said Lorne. "Was Rosie right?"
Yeah. My wife is, elsewhere, though."
He picked the things up and dropped them hastily again with a clatter.
"Well, it's just as well to be aware that giving birth isn't like shelling peas," said the doctor.
"I should bloody well hope not.
Although I have to say that the midwives seldom refer anything to me. They say men shouldn't fish around where they don't belong. We might as well be living in caves."
Lorne looked down at his patient.
"In the words of the philosopher Skeptum, the founder of my profession, am I going to get paid for this?"
Vimes investigated the money bag on the man's belt.
"Well, $6 do it," he said.
"Why would the unmentionables attack you, Sergeant? You're a policeman."
"I am, but they aren't. Don't you know about them?"
"I've patched up a few of their guests, yes," said Lorne, and Vimes noted the caution. "It didn't pay to know too much in this town. People with curious dislocations, hot wax burns, that sort of thing."
"Well, I had a little brush with Captain Swing last night," Vimes said, "and he was as polite as hell to me about it. But I'd bet my boots he knows that this lad and his friend came after me. That's his style. He'd probably want to see what I'd do."
"He's not the only one interested in you," said Lorne. "I got a message that Rosie Parr wants to see you. Well, I assume she meant you. That ungrateful bastard was the actual term she used."
"I think I owe her some money," said Vimes, "but I've no idea how much."
"Don't ask me," said Lorne, smoothing the plaster with his hand. "She generally names her price up front."
"I mean a finder's fee, or whatever it was."
"Yes, I know."
"Can't help you there, I'm afraid," said Lorne.
Vimes watched him working for a while and said,
"Know anything about Miss Batty?"
"The seamstress. She hasn't been here long."
"And she's really a seamstress?"
"For the sake of precision," said Dr. Lorne, "let us say she's a needlewoman. Apparently she heard there was a lot of work for seamstresses in the big city, and had one or two amusing misunderstandings before someone told her exactly what was meant. One of them involved me removing a crochet hook from a man's ear last week. Now she just hangs out with the rest of the girls."
"Why?"
"Because she's making a fortune, that's why," said the doctor. "Hasn't it ever occurred to you, Sergeant, that sometimes people go to a massage parlour for a real massage, for example? There's ladies all over this city with discreet signs up that say things like, 'Trousers repaired while you wait.' And a small but significant number of men make the same mistake as Sandra. There's lots of men work here in the city and leave their wives back home, and sometimes, you know, a man feels these urges, like for a sock without holes and a shirt with more than one button. The ladies pass on the work. Apparently it's quite hard to find a really good needlewoman in this city. They don't like being confused with their seamstresses. I just wondered why she hangs around street corners after curfew with a big sewing basket," said Vimes. Lorne shrugged. "Can't help you there. Right, I've finished with this gentleman. It'd be helpful if he lies still for a while." He indicated the racks of bottles behind him. "About how long will you want him to lie still for?" "You can do that." "Oh, yes. It's not accepted Ankh-Morpork medical practice, but since Ankh-Morpork medical practice would consist of hitting him on the head with a mallet, he's probably getting the best of the deal." "No, I meant that you doctors aren't supposed to hurt people, are you?" "Only in the course of normal incompetence. But I don't mind sending him to Sleepyland for another 20 minutes. Of course, if you want to wham him with the mallet, I can't stop you. The last guest of Swing I treated had several fingers pointing entirely the wrong way. So if you'd like to give him a few wallops for good luck, I could point out some quite sensitive areas." "No, thanks. I'll just haul him out the back way and drop him in an alley."
"Is that all?"
"No. Then I'll sign my name on his damn plaster cast, so he sees it when he wakes up. In bloody big letters, so it won't rub off."
"Now that's what I call a sensitive area," said Lorne. "You're an interesting man, Sergeant. You make enemies like a craftsman."
"I've never been interested in needlework," said Vimes, hoisting the man on his shoulder. "But what sort of things would a needlewoman have in her work-basket, do you think?"
"Oh, I don't know. Needles, thread, scissors, wool, that kind of thing," said Mossy Lorne.
"Not very heavy things, then," said Vimes.
"Not really. Why do you ask?"
"Oh, no reason," said Vimes, making a small mental note. "Just a thought. I'll go and drop off our friend here while I've still got some mist to lurk in."
"Fine. I'll have breakfast on when you get back. It's liver.
Calves."
The beast remembers. This time, Vimes slept soundly. He had always found it easier to sleep during the day. 25 years on nights had ground their nocturnal groove in his brain. Darkness was easier somehow. He knew how to stand still, a talent that few possess, and how to merge into the shadows. How to guard, in fact, and see without being seen. He remembered Find the Swing. A lot of it was history. The revolt would have happened with Swing or without him, but he was, as it were, the tip of the boil. He'd been trained at the Assassin's School, and should never have been allowed to join the Watch. He had too much brain to be a copper. At least, too much of the wrong kind of brain. But Swing had impressed Winder with his theories, had been let in as a sergeant, and then promoted to captain immediately. Vimes had never known why. It was probably because the officers were offended at seeing such a fine gentleman pounding the streets with the rest of the oiks. Besides, he had a weak chest or something. Vimes wasn't against intellect. Anyone with enough savvy to let go of a doorknob could be a street monster in the old days, but to make it above sergeant you needed a grab bag of guile, cunning and street wisdom that could pass for intelligence in a poor light. Swing, though, started in the wrong place. He didn't look around and watch and learn and then say, "This is how people are, how do we deal with it?" No, he sat and thought, "This is how people ought to be, how do we change them?" And that was a good enough thought for a priest, but not for a copper, because Swing's patient, pedantic way of operating had turned policing on its head. There had been that weapons law for a start. Weapons were involved in so many crimes that, Swing reasoned, reducing the number of weapons had to reduce the crime rate. Vimes wondered if he'd sat up in bed in the middle of the night and hugged himself when he dreamed that one up. Confiscate all weapons and crime would go down. It made sense. It would have worked, too, if only there had been enough coppers, say, 3 per citizen.
Amazingly, quite a few weapons were handed in. The flaw, though, was one that had somehow managed to escape Swing, and it was this. Criminals don't obey the law. It's more or less a requirement for the job. They had no particular interest in making the streets safer for anyone except themselves. And they couldn't believe what was happening. It was like Hog's Watch every day. Some citizens took the not unreasonable view that something had gone a bit askew if only naughty people were carrying arms, and they got arrested in large numbers. The average copper, when he's been kicked in the nadgers once too often and has reason to believe that his bosses don't much care, has an understandable tendency to prefer to arrest those people who won't instantly try to stab him, especially if they act a bit snotty and wear more expensive clothes than he personally can afford. The rate of arrests shot right up, and Swing had been very pleased about that. Admittedly, most of the arrests had been for possessing weaponry after dark, but quite a few had been for assaults on the watch by irate citizens. That was assault on a city official, a very heinous and despicable crime, and as such, far more important than all those thefts that were going on everywhere. It wasn't that the city was lawless. It had plenty of laws. It just didn't offer many opportunities not to break them. Swing didn't seem to have grasped the idea that the system was supposed to take criminals and, in some rough-and-ready fashion, force them into becoming honest men. Instead, he'd taken honest men and turned them into criminals. And the watch, by and large, into just another gang. And then, just when the whole wretched stew was thickening, he'd invented craniometrics. Bad coppers had always had their ways of finding out if someone was guilty. Back in the old days, now, these included thumbscrews, hammers, small pointed bits of wood, and of course the common desk drawer, always a boon to the copper in a hurry. Swing didn't need any of this. He could tell if you were guilty by looking at your eyebrows. He measured people. He used calipers and a steel ruler. And he quietly wrote down the measurements and did some sums, such as dividing the length of the nose by the circumference of the head and multiplying it by the width of the space between the eyes. And on such figures, he could infallibly tell you that you were devious, untrustworthy, and congenitally criminal. After you had spent the next 20 minutes in the company of his staff and their less sophisticated tools of inquiry, he would amazingly be proved right. Everyone was guilty of something. Vimes knew that. Every copper knew it. That was how you maintained your authority. Everyone, talking to a copper, was secretly afraid you could see their guilty secret written on their forehead. You couldn't, of course. But neither were you supposed to drag someone off the street and smash their fingers with a hammer until he told you what it was. Swing would probably have ended up face down in some alley somewhere if it wasn't for the fact that Winder had found him a useful tool. No one could sniff out conspiracies like Swing, and so he'd ended up running the unmentionables, most of whom made Sergeant Knock look like good copper of the month. Vimes had always wondered how the man had kept control, but maybe it was because the thugs recognised, in some animal way, a mind which had arrived at thuggery by the long route, and was capable of devising, in the name of reason, the kind of atrocities that unreason could only dream of. It wasn't easy living in the past. You couldn't whack someone for what they were going to do, or what the world was going to find out later. You couldn't warn people either. You didn't know what would change the future, but if he understood things right, history tended to spring back into shape. All you could change was the bits around the edges, the fine details. There was nothing he could do about the big stuff. The lilac was still going to bloom. The revolution was going to happen. Well, a kind of revolution. That wasn't really the word for what it was. There was the People's Republic of Treacle Mine Road. Truth, justice, freedom, reasonably priced love, and a hard-boiled egg. That would live for all of a few hours. A strange candle that burned too briefly and died like a firework. And there was the scouring of the House of Pain and the... Anyway, you did the job that was in front of you, like unimaginative coppers always did. He got up around 1 in the afternoon. Lorn was closeted in his surgery, doing something that involved some serious whimpering on the part of something else. Vimes knocked on the door. After a moment, it was opened a fraction. Dr. Lorn was wearing a face mask and holding a very long pair of tweezers in his hand. "Yes?"
"I'm going out," said Vimes. "Trouble?"
"Not too bad. Slidy Harris was unlucky at cards last night, that's all. Played the Ace of Hearts."
"That's an unlucky card?"
"It is if Big Tony knows he didn't deal it to you. But I'll soon have it removed.
"'If you're going to injure anyone tonight, can you do it before I go to bed? Thank you.'
Lorne shut the door. Vimes nodded at the woodwork and went out to stretch his legs and get some lunch. It was waiting for him on a tray around the neck of a man. Quite a young man now, but there was something about the expression, as of a rat who was expecting cheese right around the next corner, and had been expecting cheese around the last corner too, and the corner before that. And, although the world had turned out so far to be full of corners, yet completely innocent of any cheese at all, was nevertheless quite certain that, just around the corner, cheese awaited. Vimes stared. But why should he be surprised? As long ago as he could remember, there was always someone selling highly suspicious chemically reclaimed pork products in this town. The seller was very familiar, just younger. His expression lit up at the sight of an unfamiliar face. The seller liked to meet people who hadn't yet bought one of his pies.
"Ah, Sergeant! Hey, what's the little crown mean?"
"Sergeant-at-arms," said Vimes. "That's like Sergeant with all the trimmings."
"Well, Sergeant, could I interest you in a very special sausage in a bun? Guaranteed no rat. 100% organic. All pork shaved before mixing."
Why not? Thought Vimes. And his stomach, liver, kidneys, and lengths of intestine all supplied reasons, but he fumbled in his pocket for some change anyway.
"How much, Mr. Rare?"
Vimes remembered in time, and made a show of looking at the name on the front of the tray.
"Dibbler?"
4 pence, Sergeant."
"And that's cutting your own throat, eh?" said Vimes jovially.
"Pardon?" said Dibbler, looking puzzled.
"I said, a price like that's cutting your own throat, eh?"
"Cutting my own throat?" said Vimes desperately.
"Oh."
Dibbler thought about this.
"Right, yeah, it is. You never said a true word. So you'll have one, then."
"I notice it says on your tray, Dibbler Enterprises Est," said Vimes. "Shouldn't it say when you were established?"
"Should it?"
Dibbler looked down at his tray.
"How long you been going?" said Vimes, selecting a pie. "Let's see, what year is this?"
Dancing Dog, I think."
"Since Tuesday, then," said Dibbler.
His face brightened.
"But this is only the start, mister. This is just to get a stake together. In a year or two I'm going to be a big man in this town."
"I believe you," said Vimes. "I really do." Dibbler looked down at his tray again as Vimes strolled off.
"Cutting my own throat. Cutting my own throat," he mumbled to himself,
and seemed to like the sound of it. But then he focused more clearly on the tray and his face went pale.
"Sergeant," he shouted, "don't eat the pie."
Vimes, a few yards away, stopped with the pie halfway to his mouth.
"What's wrong with it?" he said.
"Silly me. I mean, what's uniquely wrong with it?"
"Nothing. I mean, these are better."
Vimes risked another look at the tray. They all looked the same to him. Dibbler's pies quite often looked appetizing. Therein lay their one and only charm.
"I can't see any difference," he said.
Yeah, there is," said Dibbler, sweat beading on his forehead. "See, the one you got has got a little pattern of pastry pigs on it, and all the others are pastry sausages. I'd hate to think that, you know, I thought you were a pig or anything. So if you'll hand it over, I'll happily give you another one. That one's not the right one. Not that it's the wrong one, but with the pig and everything."
Vimes looked into the man's eyes. Dibbler had yet to learn that friendly blankness that 30 years of selling truly organic pies would call into being.
While the man stared in horror, he took a large bite out of the pie. It was everything that he had expected, and nothing that he could identify.
"Yum," he said, and, with some concentration, eyes fixed on the luckless pieman, finished it all.
"I think it's quite possible no one else makes pies like you do, Mr. Dibbler," he said, licking his fingers in case he might want to shake hands with someone later on.
"You ate it all," said Dibbler.
"Was that wrong?" said Vimes. And now relief rose off the man like smoke off a greenwood fire.
"What? No, that's fine. Jolly good. Want another one to help it down? Half price."
"No, no, one is more than enough," said Vimes, backing away.
"You finished every bit?" said Dibbler.
"That was right, wasn't it?" said Vimes.
"Oh, yeah, sure, yeah, obviously."
"Got me going," said Vimes, moving on down the lane. "I'll look forward to seeing you again when I've got less appetite."
He waited until he was well out of sight before taking a few random turns in the network of alleys.
Then he stepped into the shadow of a deep doorway and felt in his mouth for the piece of pie that had seemed curiously unchewable even by pie standards. Usually, if you found something more than usually hard or crunchy in one of Dibbler's famous pork pies, the trick was to either swallow it and hope for the best, or spit it out with your eyes closed. But Vimes felt around between gum and cheek and fished out a folded piece of paper, stained with unknowable juices. He unfolded it. In smudged pencil, but still decipherable, it read, Morphic Street, 9 o'clock tonight, password Swordfish. Swordfish. Every password was Swordfish. Whenever anyone tried to think of a word that no one would ever guess, they always chose Swordfish. It was just one of those strange quirks of the human mind. That explained the guilt, anyway. A plot. Another damn plot in a city full of plots. Did he need to know about plots? Anyway, he knew about this one, Morphic Street. The famous Morphic Street conspiracy. He pushed the greasy scrap into a pocket and then hesitated. Someone was being quiet. Overlaid on the distant street noises was a sort of hollow in the sounds, filled by careful breathing, and the hairs on the back of his neck were standing up. Quietly, he pulled the blackjack out of his rear pocket. Now, what were the options? He was a copper, and someone was creeping up on him. If they weren't a copper, then they were in the wrong, because he was a copper. If they were a copper too, then they were one of Swing's crew and therefore in the wrong, because he was a better copper than them, and so were things floating in gutters. And therefore, delivering a swift bucketful of darkness had no obvious downside. On the other hand, thieves, assassins, and Swing's men, by all accounts, did a lot of creeping up on people and were probably pretty good at it, whereas the person tracking him was keeping their back so close to the wall he could hear the scraping. That meant they were probably just a member of the public, with something on their mind, and he was not inclined to add several ounces of lead shot simply for that reason, because he'd like to believe he wasn't that sort of copper. He settled for stepping out into the alley and saying, "Yeah?" A boy stared up at him. It had to be a boy. Nature would not have been so cruel as to do that to a girl. No single feature in itself was more than passably ugly, but the combination was greater than the sum of the parts. There was also the smell. It wasn't bad as such. It just wasn't entirely human. There was something feral about it.
"Eh," said its pinched-up face. "Look, tell you what, mister. You tell me where you're going, and I'll stop following you. Have we got a deal? Costs you no more than a penny, and that's a special price. Sadbeat will pay me a lot more than that to stop following them."
Vimes continued to stare. The creature was wearing an oversized evening dress jacket, shiny with grease and greenish with age, and a top hat that must once have been trodden on by a horse. But the bits that were visible between the two were regrettably familiar. "Oh, no," he moaned. "No, no, no."
"You're right, mister."
"No, no, no. Oh, ye gods, it had to happen, didn't it?
You want us to go and fetch Mossy, mister?"
Vimes pointed an accusing finger.
"You're Nobby Nobs, right?"
The urchin backed away.
"Might be. So what? Is that a crime?"
He turned to run, but Vimes's hand fell heavily on the shoulder.
"Some people might say so. You're Nobby Nobs, son of Maisie Nobs and Sconner Nobs. Probably, probably. But I ain't done nothing, mister."
Vimes bent down to look into eyes that peered out at the world through a mask of grime.
"How about whizzing wipers, snitching tinklers, pulling wobblers, flogging tumblers, and running rambles?"
Nobby's brow creased in genuine puzzlement.
"What's pulling wobblers mean?" he said.
Vimes gave him a similar look. Street parley had changed a lot in 30 years.
"That's stealing trifles, small items, isn't it?" "No, no, no, mister, that's tottering Neville's," said Nobby, relaxing. "But you ain't doing badly for someone who's new. What's Oil of Angels?"
Memory flicked a card.
"A bribe," said Vimes. "And a dimber?"
said Nobby, grinning.
"Easy. Could be a head beggar, could be just a handsome man." "Well done. Bet you don't know how to fleeg a jade, though."
Once again, from a dusty recess, a memory unrolled. This one stuck in your mind.
"Dear me, do you know what? What a shame in one so young," said Vimes. "That's when you want to sell a broken-down horse and have to make it a bit frisky in front of the punters, and so you take some fresh, raw, hot ginger, lift up its tail, and push the ginger." "Caw!"
said Nobby, suddenly impressed.
Everyone says you're a real quick learner, and that's true enough. You could have been born here.
Why are you following me, Nobby Nobs? Said Vimes.
The urchin held out a grubby hand. Some street language never changes. Vimes pulled out sixpence. It shone in Nobby's palm like a diamond in a chimney sweep's ear.
One of 'em's a lady, he said and grinned.
The hand stayed out.
That was a bloody sixpence I just gave you, kid, Vimes growled.
Yeah, but I got to think of...
Vimes grabbed the lapels of Nobby's greasy coat and lifted him up and was mildly shocked to realise that there was practically no weight there.
Street urchin, he thought. Urchin sounds about right, spiky, slimy, and smelling slightly of rotting seaweed. But there's hundreds of them round here, clawing a living off the very margins, and as I recall, Nobby was one of the sharpest, and as trustworthy as a chocolate hammer. But that's okay. There's ways to deal with that.
How much, he said, for you to work for me all the time?
I got customers to think of, he began.
Yeah, but I'm the one holding you up in one hand, right? Said Vimes.
With his oversized boots dangling a foot above the ground, Nobby considered his position.
All the time?
Right.
For something like that, I've got to be looking at a lordship every day.
A dollar, guess again.
Half a dollar?
Not a chance. A dollar a week, and I won't make your life the utter misery which, Nobby, I assure you, I can do in so many little ways.
Still dangling, Nobby tried to work all this out.
So, I'll be, kind of like a copper, right?
He said, grinning artfully.
Kind of.
Number one suspect says it's a good life being a copper, because you can pinch stuff without getting nicked.
He's got that right, said Vimes.
And he says if anyone gives you lip, you can bop 'em one and chuck 'em in the tanty,
Nobby went on.
I'd like to be a copper one day.
Who's number one suspect?
That's what our man calls Sconner, our dad. Payment up front, yeah?
Nobby added, hopefully.
What do you think?
Ah, right. No, eh?
Correct. But I'll tell you what.
He lowered Nobby to the ground. Light as a feather, he thought.
You come with me, kid.